We know that given the timeline at this point, it's going to be impossible to get a new plan implemented in time.
The redistricting board plans to appeal the latest rejection of its map. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, small changes at Providence Hospital yield big results in the quality of care.
A few years ago, there was a lot of argument about, okay, who told me I have to use that antibiotic? So it's been one doctor at a time, one process at a time, one surgery at a time.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Association of Alaska School Boards promotes one-to-one digital learning for all Alaska students to prepare them for success in the global economy. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
It's back to the drawing board for the Alaska redistricting plan after a state superior court decision sent an amended plan back to the panel last week. The state's redistricting board met today to deal with the latest court rejection of the map of Alaska voting districts. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
After a brief meeting, most of it in executive session, the state's redistricting board decided to take their voting plan back to the courts. Redistricting Board Executive Director Taylor Bickford says the next step is the Alaska Supreme Court, where the board will be asking the High Court to overturn the Superior Court decision and adopt the amended plan.
So the board decided to appeal the April 20th decision. We will need to file that by the end of the week. So our legal team will now spend the next few days putting that appeal together. The other thing the board decided to do was authorize legal counsel to start preparing the petition to the court to use the interim plan for 2012.
He says board chair John Torgerson will decide when the petition is filed. Bickford says it's likely that the petition will be filed because it's too late for the panel to meet a June 1st deadline to draw up a map that meets state court approval.
We know that given the timeline at this point, it's going to be impossible to get a new plan implemented in time. Quite frankly, we probably didn't have enough time after the Supreme Court's original ruling, just given the length of time it takes to get approval from the Justice Department. And so that's something that really is out of our control. You know, every redistricting plan in the state's history has always been thrown back by the Supreme Court. And in our case, because we were asked to change the native districts, we were put in this uncomfortable position of having to come up with a new plan that would also need federal preclearance.
Last week, a Superior Court judge ruled that the board needs to draw a redistricting plan in which every district complies with the so-called Hickel process, which ensures that the board draw up a reapportionment plan based on the requirements of the Alaska Constitution. Bickford says the litigation process is about the interplay between the state constitution and the federal Voting Rights Act.
And there's inherently a conflict there. And so we got preclearance from the federal government this fall. They said, you did your job. And now what the state court is saying is you've gone too far in favor of the Federal Voting Rights Act. So it's a demographics issue. It's all about the changing population of the state and the fact that the native districts had to be so significantly changed.
The board had filed the amended plan with the Superior Court earlier this month in compliance with a March Alaska Supreme Court order. But seven groups filed suit against the amended plan, all saying that the amended plan does not comply with the so-called Hickel process. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A man from the Bering Sea village of Hooper Bay has been awarded $500,000 for being excessively tasered by village police officers. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
A Bethel jury has found that 35-year-old Thomas Boya Olson was tasered between 15 and 18 times, which constituted excessive force. The jury also found that excessive force was a substantial factor in causing harm to Olson. There were four defendants in the case, the three Hooper Bay officers, Dimitri Oakes, Charles Simon, and Nathan Joseph. The city of Hooper Bay was also a defendant. The tasering happened on December 26th of 2006, when Olson was 30 years old. Since then, the case has gone all the way to the Alaska Supreme Court and back to Bethel over the last 5 years. Last week's trial decided some of the damages. The jury awarded Olson $500,000, half for damages that he has already received from the incident, and the other half for damages he will receive in the future because of it. During the trial, Olson said that he had 4 scars from being tasered that day. In court, details of the event unfolded, although the particulars of which were argued until the end. It started with the officers responding to Olson's home for a complaint. There, they found him asleep, woke him up, and handcuffed him. They said he was endangering the children in the home because he had been drinking. Alcohol is illegal in Hooper Bay through Alaska's local option law. When the 3 officers were escorting Olson out of his house, they said he did not go quietly. They said they fell to the floor and Olson started kicking all of them. That's when they used their tasers. The officers said they continued to taser Olson because not all of their attempts made proper contact and were not effective, and because Olson continued to fight them. Olson's side of the story differed in some important details. He said he had only had a few drinks that night and wasn't drunk. He said while he was being escorted out, they slipped and fell on the floor because it was dirty and wet. He said he resisted going with the officers because he didn't want to leave his children alone without their mother there. Olson did admit to kicking the officers multiple times, but said he was tasered while he was handcuffed on the floor while on his stomach. He said at some point he was tasered by more than one officer simultaneously. Additional punitive damages in the case will be considered separately in court. That's scheduled for May 8th in Bethel. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Rocker Ted Nugent today pleaded guilty to transporting a black bear he illegally killed near Heidelberg in May of 2009. Nugent committed the misdemeanor violation while filming a show for the outdoor channel called Spirit of the Wild. According to a plea agreement, the defendant was bow hunting near Prince of Wales Island when he wounded a black bear. Nugent failed to locate and harvest the wounded black bear. He then shot and killed another bear and transported it on board the fishing vessel El Dorado. According to state law, the first bear counted toward Nugent's seasonal bag limit of 1. On Tuesday, Nugent pleaded guilty to 1 misdemeanor violation of the Lacey Act, which prohibits the transport of wildlife taken illegally. Appearing telephonically, Nugent said he cherishes his time hunting and that he would never knowingly break any game laws. Nugent said he was blindsided by the violation and offered his apologies to the court. Residents of Diomede could soon have weekly helicopter service for the first time since 2009. The state's recently passed operating budget includes $200,000 to match a federal subsidy through the Essential Air Service Program. The money still must be approved by the governor. Diomede's ice runway provides for air service for a few months during the spring. After switching aircraft in 2009, Evergreen Helicopters suspended scheduled flights and stopped all air service at one point in 2010 due to maintenance issues. Residents have gone months at a time without any transportation. A regional nonprofit, Kowarik, has been spearheading the effort and would administer the program with EAS and the State Department of Transportation. Kowarik Executive Vice President Melanie Banky says the company is hopeful as the plan goes across the governor's desk.
Our argument has been all along that the state has an obligation to ensure transportation within the state of Alaska. There are several communities that receive the 100% subsidy right now that also get ferry services because of the state of Alaska. So we've got communities that benefit in more ways than one, and yet we've got a community here in our region that goes for months without any passenger services for months at a time.
Diomede is not on the list of communities eligible for full EAS funding because it did not have scheduled service when the airlines were deregulated in the late 70s. Senator Donnie Olson, a Democrat from Nome, helped put the money in the state budget. Olson says air service is very much a public health issue.
If for some reason somebody has a problem with a pregnant woman is delivering out there, and there's an issue about that can happen, like bleeding, and then we can't get them out, and so that's why I feel so strongly about it.
According to Kowarik, a round-trip helicopter ticket between Diomede and Nome currently costs $640, but is only possible if space is available. The price of airfare would be determined through a competitive process. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a museum exhibit that looks at the largest mountain in North America.
In short, this exhibit is about the relationship that people have with Denali.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
Medicare is starting to reward hospitals that deliver better quality health care. Paying more for improved care is a simple idea, and it's transforming how hospitals are doing their work in a lot of little ways. At Providence Hospital in Anchorage, a few of those small changes have added up to big results. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
In a bright room on the cardiovascular unit at Providence, Gennaro Reyes is perched on the edge of his bed in hospital-issued pajamas. The 58-year-old cannery worker from Cordova was recently medevaced to Anchorage after he woke up in the middle of the night, barely able to breathe. Today, he's talking to a new type of health worker at Providence.
When you came into the hospital, tell me what it was like for you. Did you have a hard time breathing?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you have swollen legs, or talk to me about how you felt?
Hardly breathe, ma'am.
Yeah.
Nurse Micah Henning became the hospital's first clinical heart failure coordinator in 2008. One of her main jobs is to help keep heart failure patients like Reyes from coming back to the hospital within 30 days.
If you have a large percentage of heart failure patients readmitting within the first month, it's generally thought you didn't do something necessarily you needed to do, that it may be partially our fault.
And starting this fall, under the Affordable Care Act, hospitals with too many readmissions will lose Medicare dollars. So Henning sits down with every heart failure patient and makes sure they understand their condition. She gives them calendars so they can easily track their weight to monitor for fluid retention, a telltale sign of heart trouble. And she even hands out free scales if patients can't afford them. Basically, Henning makes sure patients get the most out of their treatment.
Teaching them how to do the right thing for their diagnosis helps them to feel better, to live better, and have a better quality of life. And that's really the purpose.
The program has helped Providence dramatically reduce the number of readmissions. When Henning started, about 17% of heart failure patients were back to the hospital within 30 days. Last year, that figure dropped to just under 11%. The national average is almost 20%. That puts Providence in a competitive position as more and more Medicare dollars are tied to quality measures. Dr. Dick Monsager is chief executive at Providence. He says every hospital in the country is feeling the pressure to improve care.
As the variation in performance narrows and narrows and narrows, good isn't good enough. You got to be great.
Working towards greatness has yielded some impressive results. 6 years ago, Providence started focusing on reducing central line infections in its pediatric unit. Those are the catheters used to give medicine, fluids, and nutrients to very sick patients. They're also prime conduits for hospital-acquired infection, which can be deadly. Dr. Monsager says he used to think some infections were inevitable.
The word none, as an aspiration, I didn't think was possible in a complex hospital environment.
But Dr. Monsager says Providence hasn't had a central line infection in its pediatric unit in 3 years, and the rates for central line infections in adults have dropped in half. Improving the quality of care at the hospital has involved streamlining systems and convincing doctors to follow very specific checklists for each medical condition. He says some doctors have criticized it as cookie-cutter medicine.
A few years ago, there was a lot of argument about, okay, who told me I have to use that antibiotic? And the rules are very specific for certain conditions. Only certain antibiotics are okay. So it's been one doctor at a time, one process at a time, one surgery at a time.
Working on these problems is hard and costs money, but more and more it's what will be required of hospitals. By Dr. Monsager's estimate, in another 5 years, up to 7% of Medicare dollars will be at risk over performance measures. At Providence alone, that amounts to about $5 million each year. Dr. Monsager says overall, it's a positive change.
Yes, it's a more complicated future from a hospital point of view, and yes, there's more risk, and yes, there isn't enough money to afford the American medicine. We've got to change. But with all of that being true, the incentives and challenges to say we got to do better, we got to be safer, I don't disagree with any of that.
As a hospital administrator, Dr. Monsager says he would prefer more payment certainty, but he says the new payment incentives are helping hospitals imagine a future that's safer and safer and safer. And it's hard to argue with that. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Big changes are in the works at Southeast Alaska's largest private employer. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, has a hospital in Sitka, doctors in Juneau, a variety of clinics, and roughly 1,000 employees. The organization is working to recover from a $4 million loss in the last year. That has meant changes to benefits and a hiring slowdown, among other things. New chief executive Charles Clement is behind a lot of those changes. KCAW's Ed Ronco talked to Clement and has this story.
Charles Clement says he knew going into his job at SEARCH that the organization had some obstacles to overcome. But he says the picture of just what those obstacles were became a lot clearer once he started work.
The day that I got here, it was immediately apparent. There's issues with, creditors and accounts payable and vendors. And so it was pretty obvious that there were some challenges walking in the door. And, my approach has been and continues to be trying to be as completely forthright with stakeholders as possible.
So he emailed all 1,000 or so employees and told them that the nonprofit healthcare consortium lost $4 million in 2011. And he said changes were on the way. He wrote that those changes would be difficult, perhaps even heart-wrenching. It was a different picture than the one painted just a year earlier. Then CEO Roald Helgeson noted in the organization's 2010 annual report that finances were in balance. So what happened between then and now? Clement says SEARCH, like many tribal organizations, received windfalls from federal stimulus money during the economic downturn.
SEARCH has grown. Undoubtedly, it has grown over the years. And if you look at our ability to sustain based on our year-over-year operations, it is just not there. And so what we've been relying on is these unanticipated windfalls to support operations. So in the year where these unanticipated windfalls don't come in, we're sort of left in a lurch.
SEARCH has not laid off employees, but last week it announced a hiring slowdown. Clement says many vacancies that don't directly deal with patients are on hold. Clement says he's trying to maintain transparency, to keep employees in the loop and give them a voice as much as possible. That transparency has, at times, crossed into uncomfortable territory. In January, Clement was arrested in Anchorage for driving under the influence and domestic violence assault. Those charges were dropped in February, and Clement pleaded no contest to disorderly conduct. In a letter to staff after his court appearance, Clement apologized for how the incident might have reflected on SEARCH and said, quote, "I have never denied consuming alcohol and then driving. I took my injured wife to the nearby hospital and then returned home to be with my kids," unquote. Clement says the incident was a learning experience.
Sometimes you make mistakes that are more high profile than other times, and it doesn't matter. You have to approach them the same way, that you have to stand up in a tone and you got to keep moving forward and moving on. I mean, you got to grow and learn, but you can't stop and you can't put your head in a hole.
The original charges included domestic violence assault and driving under the influence. A large part of SEARCH's mission deals with the treatment and prevention of those two things. Did that incident affect, especially given the time frame in which it happened right before you came on the job, did it affect your ability to lead when you got here?
I would imagine it has. I think I would make maybe it's I've used a different set of tools to try to lead. And, I mean, this is something that happened in my life that not a day goes by that I don't think about. And because it's really shaped me profoundly in terms of, this being a public or somewhat public figure is a new experience for me. And, the bulk of my life, I've been, the guy down the street, just average Joe. And so all of a sudden caring what publicly people think about you or what they may know about you is really a new experience. And so it's hard for me to pull the two apart. The fact of the matter is every day I have to make difficult choices about things that happen here at SEARCH. And I have to wonder, do people think this? Do they think that? And this is one more thing that goes into that equation.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Fairbanks turned out last night to support the family of a baby who died last week as the result of child abuse. The event was organized by Interior Alaska Native leaders for the family of 2-year-old Jacob Williams, who died of injuries inflicted by his mother's boyfriend. Williams' family is from Allakaket, and last night's gathering raised money for funeral services in the village. One of the organizers, Tisha Simmons, says there was also a broader goal.
You know, it's a really good opportunity for us to make something good come out of a really tragic situation. And if you look around the crowd tonight, I think you'll see the diversity of people that are attending tonight and the passion that is being shown to stand against child abuse.
Hundreds of people turned out to buy food, auction items, and raffle tickets, and listen to speakers address domestic violence and child abuse awareness and prevention. Reverend Anna Frank says people are feeling sad and angry and asking questions about abusive relationships.
Why do they stay in that situation? A lot of them think that this is what love is all about. And some of them stay in the situation because they're lonely, they think they couldn't get anybody else, and they would rather stay there than move on. So we need to educate the young men and women and how to become healthy. Healthiness is what we want.
Reverend Frank says information on how to recognize abusive people and get out of dangerous situations needs to be continually pushed. She laid the responsibility on agencies, organizations, and individuals. The man accused in Jacob Williams' death, Carl Delbert David Jr., is jailed on a first-degree assault charge. District Attorney Mike Gray says a grand jury is expected to convene this week and will likely up the charge to second-degree murder. An exhibit about Denali just opened at the Anchorage Museum. It includes the 50-pound camera that Bradford Washburn used to photograph the mountain, a rare map from 1839 which uses its Athabascan name for the first time, and homemade crampons made in Fairbanks for the 1910 sourdough expedition. As KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports, the exhibition, which opened earlier this month, looks at North America's highest peak from many perspectives.
At 20,320 feet, Denali dominates the landscape in south-central Alaska, at least on a clear day. And you can't help but feel something when you see it. Curator Zhenya Anishenko hopes the exhibit gets at that feeling.
In short, this exhibit is about the relationship that people have with Denali.
The exhibit's called The High One, Reaching the Top, and climbing the peak is one of its central themes. It features historical gear, documents, and photos, but it also highlights the role the mountain plays in the Alaska Native oral tradition.
We start from a native perception of Denali, and one of the very first things you see in the exhibit is an Athabascan legend about how Denali formed. And it's a legend which was recorded in 1905, and we had an Athabascan storyteller narrating it.
Chickaloon tribal member Patricia Wade tells the story of a young man who's caught in a great flood and throws his harpoon at the crest of a big wave.
The wave he had hit with his harpoon had become a mountain. It is the one we call Tatsun Tukitkoitin, the one whose top was hit by the raven. The harpoon had glanced on the mountaintop as the wave hardened into rock and had struck again another huge wave, changing it into a mountain. This is the one we call Denali, the High One.
Denali continues to captivate the imagination of the people who live in Alaska today, drawing tourists and climbers from across the globe. According to the National Park Service, more than 37,000 climbers attempted to summit the mountain during the past 108 years. About half of them made it. Anachenko says the exhibit asks the question, why do people climb it?
You know, what is that hold mountains have on people's lives? What draws people to the mountains?
The exhibit has several interactive displays that explore climbing, including a table where visitors can try on three different kinds of backpacks used to summit the mountain over the years, and a bulletin board where visitors can post a note saying why they like to climb. Anachenko reads a few.
One of my favorites is anonymous statement a woman or a man wrote that they climb because there are no kids or dogs. Oh, there is one funny one right here. To feel like dragons felt.
The exhibit also delves into the tension between native and colonial views of the mountain, exploring the ongoing controversy about what to call it. The story goes that in the late 1890s, a gold prospector named the mountain McKinley, as political support for then-President William McKinley. The Alaska Board of Geographic Names changed the name of the mountain to the Alaska native name, Denali, which is how locals refer to it. However, federally, it's still known as McKinley. The exhibit lets museum goers vote for the name they prefer by placing a bead into a clear tube.
You could kind of visually see right now that Denali is definitely winning over McKinley.
In Alaska, there are also different opinions about how to pronounce Denali. Outsiders usually say Denali, while locals tend toward Denali. They both come from the Koyukon Athabascan name for the mountain, Denali. I found Tracy Warner in front of the bead voting display.
I'm with the Chugiak Elementary School out in Chugiak, Alaska, and we're here on our field trip. And I voted for Denali because that is my son's middle name.
Warner's daughter, however, couldn't decide.
I put one bead in both.
You can cast your bead for Denali or McKinley or both and check out the rest of the exhibition, The High One, through October 21st. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
To see photos from the exhibit, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ben Matheson in Nome, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.